Welcome back to Two-Way Talk here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9, absolutely the voice of the community. I'm Carol Williams.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Davon Love is a Baltimore-based political organizer and the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots think tank that advances the public policy interests of Black people. In 2010, Love co-founded Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, one of many organizations that successfully pressured the state of Maryland to disband its plans to build a juvenile jail downtown. He has a book out called Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation. Welcome, Davon Love, to Two-Way Talk.
Thanks for having me. Good to meet you and good to hear you again, Anthony.
Thank you. Great to have you.
Nice to meet you.
Our show, Davon. I did not realize it has been that long since Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle was founded. It has been
right.
A while.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the book. A very, very catchy title, Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation. Tell us where the title came from.
So I actually started writing it probably a third of the way through 2016.
Wow.
And I was writing it during a moment when, for many people, it seemed like, you know, Donald Trump really had no chance of winning the election.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people, I think, at the time were under that impression. And what I was observing was a lot of the social justice national figures. I was observing the complacency around the exploitative relationships that Black people as a people have with many of the institutions they claim to represent them.
Of course.
Namely, the Democratic Party, elements of the nonprofit sector, the institutional left, you know, just generally. And so I was essentially writing for the purpose of thinking that, because I figured in the moment that Hillary Clinton would win,
mm-hmm.
that it would be claimed as a triumph for Black people and for social justice. So I was writing it initially to counter what I thought was going to be the wave
of
self-congratulatory discourse around that. So when Trump won, it changed how I was writing it.
Mm.
And what I began to observe was that all of the conversations, particularly in national spaces that related to social justice, was all centered around Trump being the worst thing that ever happened.
Mm.
And one of the things that was complicated about even thinking about writing the book, because it actually was published a couple of years ago while Trump was still in office.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my thinking was that being able to hold the fact that Trump as a political figure is harmful, but also recognizing the way in which so much attention was paid to Trump, that it allowed for the exploitative relationship that Black folks have to the institutions that I named as examples, it further allowed and justified,
mm-hmm.
reified those dynamics. And so really, the Worse Than Trump piece is really about checking those who use their opposition to Trump,
mm-hmm.
as their sole social justice credibility, when in fact, in many regards, that's the cheapest thing one can do. Like,
mm-hmm.
Trump is so obviously a disaster.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That if that's the cheapest thing you can do as opposed to Trump. And what we really need to do is address some of these dynamics that I talk about in the book.
So, Davon, let me ask you, how in the world can we have a conversation around the exploitative nature of our so-called allied institutions? So many times I grow so weary and weak listening to people. The only standard for the Democratic Party is that it's not the Republican Party. The only standard we have for a lot of institutions are they're better than our enemies or better than people that are treating us or, mm-hmm. and are putting things in place that really are detrimental to the welfare of Black people. But the standard has to be higher than that.
Right.
It has to be higher than not being the Republican Party.
Right. And so a few things with that. One is one of the things that is left out of some of the more mainstream social justice discourses is the importance of building independent Black formations,
yeah.
right, that are autonomous and are well-resourced. And that, to me, represents one of the biggest flaws in the broader social justice discourse, because while people are more comfortable talking about police brutality or mass incarceration or just racism in general in terms of the harm that's done to Black people,
mm-hmm.
what often happens is that the solutions that follow are solutions that re-entrench our collective dependence on institutions outside of our community, right? So we think about, like, the nonprofit sector. One of the things I write about in the book, you know, as a person that really sees the importance of history, prior to the civil rights movement and prior to desegregation, there were, you know, autonomous black social containers, right, that were essentially mediating with not the level of interference that there is now from larger society, mediating who our leaders were, right? Who were the spokespeople for our community, right? What were the you know, the activities that were truly led by our community? And what has happened is that, you know, many people in our community bought into the white man thinks it's colder doctrine, right? Many people in our community left our community, whether geographically, socially, culturally. And so what that did was many of our historic black social containers, right, our community organizations, our civic institutions were weakened. And what has replaced them are nonprofit entities that are often controlled by folks outside of our community. And some of them may have black faces, right? But they're often controlled by folks outside of our community. And this is something that I think has been a part of, you know, our civic life for a very long time, you know, since that post-civil rights era. But one of the importance of talking about it now is that with the emergence of social justice as something that is more mainstream, again, what gets left out is the importance of building independent black institutions as the basis for any movement around social justice. Otherwise, what many people end up advocating for is more investment in institutions outside of our community to fix us. And one of the central messages in the book is no one is going to solve our problems but us. And we should not structure solutions to our problems that make us the problem. We have to structure the solutions in institutions in our community that frame us as the solution.
So I was reading your essay. I know we're talking about your book, but I was reading your essay, When Baltimore Awakes, and with the nation being so divided, can you talk about how Baltimore perpetuates the system of white supremacy?
Yeah, so one of the things that I actually mentioned both in Worse Than Trump and in When Baltimore Awakes is Hubert Henry Harrison, in his text, in his book, Negro in the Nation. And he says the difference when before the Civil War and after the Civil War. Before the Civil War, there was chattel slavery, and after was wage slavery. The difference is that chattel slavery was enforced by brute force, and wage slavery is enforced by starvation. Right? And that last part is where we are now, where the way that white supremacy operates is that the donor class, right, those who own many of the major institutions that govern our society, have the ability to curate the political ecosystem because they're literally able to remove funding and resources, right, impact people's livelihoods in ways that literally change the trajectory of our politics. And I would argue that much of the problems that we deal with in Baltimore are dealt with because I think many people in elected office and other advocates who press beyond what it is those who hold the purse strings, whenever they go beyond those limitations, people's livelihoods are under attack. So, right? And so that's the American, that's the plantation metaphor, that we are, the plantation has not dissipated. It has just taken a different form.
So I want to invite our listeners to call in. We have Davon Love. He is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. He has a book out called Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation. Give us a call at 410-319-8888 to join our conversation. Now, Davon, it was you and Adam that have really taught me. I have become so skeptical of institutions trying to do good, in quotes, good in our community. If someone tells me they're from Able or they're from Casey or they're from some large nonprofit and they have a white face, but yet they're lecturing me on what black people need to do, I get very skeptical. Almost immediately, I just shut down and don't listen to what's being said.
And if I could just add to what you just said, it's almost like the people calling in for the apartments that are being put in over there, you have a white face and you're calling in talking about what black people need in their neighborhood. and I'll be quiet.
Nope, you're on it. You're on. And I almost wonder, and I shouldn't do this because I don't want to discount anybody's opinion. But oftentimes it makes me even more skeptical of our people mm-hmm. who are in those institutions mm-hmm. who are telling, oh, this is what Casey does. This is what Able does. This is what Joe Blow Foundation does for Black people. We yeah. have to be our solutions. Mm-hmm. We have to be our solutions.
Yep, yeah, I agree.
Yep.
Go ahead, Davon. I'm sorry.
So there are a couple of anecdotes that I talk about in the book that I think speak to that. So mm-hmm. I was for years I was a debate coach, you know, various
That's
schools
right.
around
mm-hmm.
the city. And there was one school where I was working with a gentleman who was very learned in African history. And so him and I were talking, and he says, "Davon, you know, Africans were navigating the Atlantic Ocean before Europeans were." And so my initial thought was, why we always have to have these conspiracy theories, Black people doing stuff first, uh-huh. you know, like racism exists, we don't need to go overboard. And then a few months later, I had come across like a YouTube video from a man named Ivan Van Sertima called They Came Before Columbus, which is based on a book he wrote, and then I read the book. And there were two conclusions I came to. The first was that Africans actually were navigating the Atlantic Ocean before Europeans.
That's right.
Europeans are some of the only people who believe that the world was flat. But the second conclusion I came to, I had to ask myself, why was I so, and at the time I was like 2021, I had to ask myself, why was I so willing to be dismissive of the idea?
Mm.
And what I figured out was that I had not encountered narratives of people of African descent operating in arenas marked as high levels of civilization, right? So even as someone who like understands the system mm-hmm. and understands the sociology of Black oppression, I had not encountered narratives of Black people being able to produce bodies of work
mm-hmm.
that had that level of civilizational significance, right? And so many people are operating from the vantage point, have never even conceptualized, never observed Black people being able to exert that level of intellectual, institutional, cultural, societal independence, right? And so if that's never crossed your mind, then you're going to construct programming from that perspective. You're going to produce research from that perspective. You're going to design institutions from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so it explains the dynamic that you all were just talking about, where you have, you know, white folks in some cases thinking they know better about us than we do,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they operate from a paradigm where, you know, there's no way that Black people would know better. Another anecdote that's in the book, there's a story from a woman. Actually, this is in When Baltimore Wakes, but it's relevant. There's a woman who was a scholar at a school in the Midwest in the mid-90s. She was developing a Black Studies program, and she was in the English department. So she's presenting or proposing two classes, a class on Black women writers and a class on Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And so she gives the presentation to an all-white English department. And when she's done, she says that one of the people leaned over to the chair and said, "It's amazing that she believes that Black people have written enough that there could be two separate classes on English, on Black literature."
Whoa.
Right? And I use that anecdote because I think that in many ways, many of the folks, again, who are in many of these major institutions, that's what they believe about Black people.
Yep.
Right? They don't know about the breadth and depth of our scholarship and ingenuity and the history of the work that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a big part of the work to be done is really retraining and people reeducating themselves about the work that Black people have done to solve our own problems as the basis for the development of programs and institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because with that kind of framework, it requires Black people be the author, and it requires Black people be the experts. And the last thing on this point, that if this is really where it becomes political. Because if we were to say that people of African descent who have specialized in producing solutions to our problems become the thought leader,
mm-hmm.
that shifts financial resources.
It sure does.
Current thought leaders are able to set the stage for what's best practice, what's the research that's most dominant,
mm-hmm.
right? What are the things that are conventional? And so part of the political struggle, which is why OBS is what we are, a political organization, is to say, we need to do the work to advocate to shift that ecosystem of thought leaders so that they're more representative of the community that reflects our capacity for independence and self-determination.
Mm. 410-319-8888. That's the number to join our conversation. We're talking with Davon Love, the author of Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation. Let's go to Ock. He's calling from Mount Vernon. Welcome to Two-Way Talk.
All right, how y'all doing?
Doing well. Thanks for calling.
What about all these Confederate statues? Have we gotten, how many we got rid of?
A lot. I can't think of the. I don't think there are any left in the city.
Oh, sure. In this city.
Uh-huh.
Sure it is. It's John Edgar Howard. You ever heard of him?
No. Uh-uh.
Pull him up. Roger B. Taney. You familiar with him?
I am familiar with him.
Taney,
the statue of Taney was taken down in Annapolis. It may be other places. I'm not sure. Yeah, but go ahead.
But John Edgar Howard, he's... pull him up, but he's a statue. He's still up at Mount Vernon.
And he's a Confederate?
Yeah, read up on him.
I will. Mm-hmm. But you're calling, so I want you to tell us about it.
Oh, I'm getting ready to tell you.
Okay.
You got rid of Taney, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, why ain't John Edgar Howard gone?
I'm not sure. Why don't you tell us about John? Why don't you tell us about Howard?
Well, I'm sure right now y'all pulling him up right on your...
We sure are.
All right, then.
But you called us, so I'm sure you're calling. All right, thanks for your call. Really appreciate you. Thank you. So a lot of people, I think that he makes such a good point before he got sidetracked, Dave, about the conversation around Confederate soldiers in the country, Confederate statues. There are a lot of people who argue. We got so much hate mail when Catherine Pugh started taking those Confederate statues down in the city from people saying, that is part of our history. You don't need to be taking that down. That's part of our history.
I agree.
How do we have a conversation about it if there cannot be? And remember now, those statues were put up to send a message.
Mm-hmm.
They were not about our history, to send a message that you can't take away our Confederate pride. So they started putting those statues up all over America.
But I still think those statues, wherever they are, have a story behind it that include us.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take them away, that takes away a part of our story. That was just my feeling about it. When they started taking down the statues, I was like, okay, I understand the Confederate part of it, but embedded in their story is our story.
And do you think taking a statue away will stop the stories?
No, but I think that if a young black child were to ask about that story, about that statue and what it meant, then they would be able to point them to what part we played in that,
mm-hmm.
different from the point of view of a white person looking at that statue.
I understand that. But if we are teaching our children history, they're going to know about the Confederates. They're going to know about the great divide in this country. But they're going to also not be given that whitewashed history. Let's celebrate this man on this big horse who led a Confederate army that really, really meant that you were to be enslaved.
Well, I think that along with these statues, I'm sorry, Davon.
And we don't have to have too much of a debate.
No, but I think along with these statues, because take them down, don't take them down. But I just think that our history is embedded in that. I think that they should have had plaques that talked about the whole history and not just of the white half of the
mm-hmm.
history. That's
And a lot of these statues that have been taken down are replaced with plaques that tell the entire story.
That's
and guess what? I don't believe that any part of my history has anything to do with these Confederates.
Okay.
It just doesn't.
Okay.
My history is very, the history of my people and the history of my family, very different from what was intended
mm-hmm.
by Robert E. Lee's statue that was put up, or any of these other people, statues that were put up. Davon, you are part of this conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Give us your thought on these Confederates.
So two things. One is, I actually see very little difference between, you know, founding fathers and the Confederacy.
Mm.
And you know, when you read both things that Abraham Lincoln said about
uh-huh.
not really caring about slavery but preserving the Union, when you look at the fact that really it was an economic war between and the impetus, one of the things that I think gets lost in much of the history of the Civil War is that much of the impetus behind the North
mm-hmm.
deciding to make the decision to say they wanted to abolish slavery, it was an economic war between the industrial North and the agricultural South, but it was also, when you look at the Haitian Revolution,
mm-hmm.
1804, and you look at the inspiration that it caused rebellions around the Western Hemisphere, there's documentation of people in the North going to the South, pleading for them to abolish slavery, not because it's morally good, but the fear of Haiti-like things happening in the United States. So for me, that speaks to the fact that, you know, and this is a part of the point that I make in the book, that the freedom for black people didn't come from us petitioning white people to accept it.
That's right.
It came from our self-determined activity of challenging, at the time, one of the most powerful empires in the world, talking about the Haitian Revolution, and inspiring black people to rebel against the system of enslavement, making it in the interest of the North to abolish slavery as opposed to something they did because they had some moral epiphany.
So we have a ton of callers, and we only have about 3 minutes left. So let's try to get through as many of these callers. Callers, we're going to ask you to keep your remarks or your questions as brief as possible. Let's go again to Rick from Germany. Welcome back to Two-Way Talk.
Thank you for taking my call, and I'm sorry I got fouled up.
That's
the first
all right.
time
That's
I
okay.
tried. My question to your current guest is civil war, a new civil war, possible today?
That's a deep question. Davon, what do you think?
I mean, I would say it depends on what we mean. I think the United States is a failed experiment for democracy. I think America is really a conglomeration of, you know, corporate enclaves held together at gunpoint. And a big part of where we are today is just an expression of I think, where America has always been. What I argue in the book is that it's important, especially with the increased polarization, it's even more important for black people to think about a perspective where we're building the kinds of institutions we need to be self-sufficient, or else we're going to perish.
Let's go to Tony. Tony's calling from Baltimore. Welcome to Two-Way Talk, Tony.
Hey, thanks, Anthony.
Appreciate it.
In general, I think African-Americans' knowledge of history is very poor, whether it's ancient Africa or current Africa or Black American history. I think it's very poor, primarily because we don't teach it in the home. So it's up to us to pass you know, that family history on, and also the more formal type of black history on as well. So if it has to get filtered through white Americans, we're in trouble.
We are in trouble.
Yeah, and then my very last point I want to make very quickly is, I agree with you. There's nothing the Confederate statue in the public square has in common with black American history, in my opinion. So, you know, they can tear them all down, relegate it to online history, or relegate it to you have to go to the library and learn about the Confederacy. They're no more entwined with black American history than the fact that we fought the Imperial Japanese, or the Nazis, or anyone else that this country declared war against. We fought. They are no more important to black history than any of those other groups.
Tony, thank you so very much. And I agree. I mean, I think that you can put these statues in museums. You can. There are places for these Confederate statues. I think there are places. Well, Davon, real quick, I hear the music playing, which means we got to run. Where can we get this book?
So if you go to the LBS website, lbsbaltimore.com, go to the merchandise shop section, you can purchase the book there, lbsbaltimore.com.
Oh, wonderful. So Worse Than Trump, The American Plantation. Davon Love, thank you for being with us. We'll be following Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle as the legislature goes into session in a few months. Appreciate you.
All right. Appreciate you all.
Folks, we got to take a very quick break, and then we'll be back. You're listening to Two-Way Talk.